Hiya lads and ladies, welcome to the third episode of the Saxon series. In this episode, we'll cover the darkest of eras in the history of Low Saxon, the 20th century, where the language went from spoken wide and far to heavily stigmatised, even discriminated against, and on the way out. And we'll discuss the response that elicited. Put on your wellies, because there's only one way forward, and that's through the deep end. Get ready!
The last time we covered Low Saxon history up until the 20th century.
That's right.
Starting way back in the mists of prehistory,
mm-hmm.
up to the Romantic period of the late 18th and 19th centuries. And then a lot of things change, obviously, in all respects in the 20th century, including for regional languages.
That's right. So we've had the rise and the downfall of Low Saxon.
We had the rise, yeah, we had the heyday of Low Saxon basically in the late Middle Ages, right? Related in large part to the Hanseatic League, that trading network in northern Germany, in the Netherlands, especially the northeast, in ports around that area, the Baltic and the North Sea, as far south as cities like Cologne and Bruges and Ghent and Novgorod in Russia, and Low Saxon functioning as a kind of lingua franca and deriving its importance from that situation, from that identity.
Right.
And something we didn't remark on was that, so clearly Low Saxon is not one unified language. It's just a collective name for a dialect continuum where each group of speakers, a group being like a hamlet, village, town, or city, like a geographically joined community, speaking a slightly different form of Saxon now from town to town. And then as the geographic distance increases, the differences in the language varieties also begin to increase until you get to a point where mutual understanding gets trickier. But there was a degree of standardization taking place in that Hanseatic period, where the Lübeck, the way people spoke in Lübeck, spoke what they called Sassish, Saxon. It's been called that in documents. So they probably also called it Dudish, which is a term you still see in the current word Dutch, which means the people's speech, right? So forms of the word Dutch a couple of centuries back did not necessarily mean present-day Dutch, but meant some kind of continental Germanic.
Right, and that can be seen in the German name for their language as well, which is Deutsch. The Germanic languages spoken in the Americas, like Pennsylvania Dutch, which is a form of German.
Yeah, and they call it Plautdeutsch.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean there's a different sort of German over there. In the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
which isn't, well, of course everything's related, but it isn't related as such to Low Saxon. But it's a form of German. It's a form of not high German, but not from the Alpine regions, but from the Eifel region, I think.
No, you're entirely right. So Pennsylvania Dutch refers basically to a kind of German, not to Saxon. And then Plautdeutsch, spoken in, you know, from Canada down to, I don't know, Bolivia, maybe further south, southern Brazil as well, is a kind of Saxon. And then Plautdeutsch, or Platt, in northern Germany, Dutch. You know, Dutch is just the same word.
Mm-hmm.
In one case, it refers to Saxony. In the other case, it refers to Dutch. So Lübeck, that Hanseatic town on the north coast of Germany, had a standardizing influence on the language, but it never quite got to a point where there was a unified language, and the Hanseatic League, that trading network, started to disintegrate and to just, you know, it was being battered by the blows of competition from the Hollanders and from other powers. Southern Germany became more economically and culturally prominent. So the language, you could say it was this close to making it, right, Martin? But it didn't.
That's right.
And then it all went downhill just you know, at that crucial moment when it hadn't quite become a standard language, but it was sort of going there.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great summary. There isn't much more I can add to that. You know, the early 19th century or the early 20th century really isn't my forte. I haven't really looked into that much. So I think this is your area of expertise, but yeah, what can be said is that I think somewhere in the early 1900s, the school system changed in the Netherlands. I don't know about Germany, but of course we had on the German side, the German state was formed, like the Weimarana Republic. So that was more of a centralized government, whereas we first had these separate states like Prussia and Hanover and hundreds of little areas that didn't really have much to do with each other, apart from the trade, of course. So there wasn't a need as such for a language that, you know, everyone supposedly understood. But with the formation of these new states, a new national conscience emerged, and people said, well, everybody needs to speak the same, and we're going to have one language of institution, or one language of education, and that's going to be High German in Germany. And the same happened in the Netherlands. Well, Dutch had already been a language of education, but the level of education, or the mandatory nature of education, that was something new. Usually the young people in the rural areas of the Netherlands and Germany, they went to school only for a couple of years. So they had the basics, the very basics of either Dutch writing or High German writing. But then schooling improved. So people had to stay in school longer and learn more Dutch.
Sure. I mean, what you see, so the 19th century is characterized by a number of big trends, right? Nationalism, the formation of clearly delineated states with a unifying system of law and language and what have you. Industrialism, or industrialization rather, Romanticism.
Mm-hmm.
Romanticism drawing attention to things like the regional languages, because they were considered romantic in the sense that they have a long tradition and maybe were a key to cultural traditions that were quite old and could be studied and unlocked by paying attention to what had formerly received very, very, very little attention. So in that sense, Romanticism did a thing or two for local languages like Saxon, or non-national languages.
But only slightly, yes.
It gave it an impulse. Although what I was going to say was that the trends that you describe of more and more education, people stay in school longer, people don't just go to, initially they go to primary school, they have a couple of years of schooling, then you get secondary school, then well into the 20th century, second half really, it becomes common for people more and more common for people to go to university, for women as well, you know, tertiary education comes up. And all of this, benefits what is now the standard language of each country. And takes away from regional languages that play no role in this expansion of education, of mass media and et cetera. Now, Romanticism, helps the regional languages in the sense that they, draw attention to them. So in the 19th century, you get these, local dignitaries, like clergymen and doctors and educated people who start, writing down texts in regional types of speech that are virtually never been written down. The exact way people spoke, which was different from what was now the standard language, right? But this romanticism also implied people beginning to write verse and literature again in Saxon. In the Netherlands, there wasn't very much going on in this respect, but in Germany, actually, in the 19th century, you had a couple of big authors, and I'm actually realizing now that we're going to talk about the 20th century, but we're kind of stuck a bit before that. But maybe we're expanding on what led up to the 20th century in order to elucidate right. better,
mm-hmm.
you know, what conditions were in place for the 20th century for things to develop there as they did. So
exactly.
So in Germany, you had a couple of authors like Klaus Groth, Fritz Reuter, John Brinkmann, and several others who wrote these poetry collections and fat novels in the Saxon of their area. So for Klaus Groth, that was Schleswig-Holstein. In the case of Fritz Reuter, it was Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. And they were very successful. They drew a lot of attention to themselves. They were read across the border. Like I've seen, like early 20th century, Dutch, translations of these Saxon novels of Reuter. So they were big writers. In the Netherlands, this literary scene was smaller. Mm-hmm. And was in many cases restricted to poetry and regional novels,
and fairly rurally oriented as well. I can only remember one poem, I think, by Beerns. Do you know him? Like in the 19th century, the school, the headmaster of somewhere in the east of Twente. He had this one poem in Low Saxon, in the local Twente Low Saxon, about a horse or something. And that was it.
I don't know his specific case, but the subdivisions that exist in Saxon, like Grenners and Drens, historians, literary historians have been now identified like the first piece written, piece of a literary nature written in that variety of Saxon, like for Grenners, I believe it's a short play called Et en Fret, from 1790, something thereabouts. And then you look at the province of Drenthe and Drenthe, and the first things being written are of the 1830s, maybe thereabouts. And it's very similar for each region. With a slightly more important tradition in that respect for the German areas.
Right, and there was one, I remember there was one set of stories from Van Wingerden, which is from my hometown of Riesen, and he wrote the Met een Old Meester bij een Heert, which is like with the old master at the hearth, I believe. And he had these short stories and short poems and wedding poems. Those were important as well. And I think the wedding poems are one of the best preserved types of writing that exist to this day, that, you know, that we can read and that have been preserved in, for instance, the Twentse Taalbank. You were saying...
Well, can you expand on that a little? So what exactly is a wedding poem, and in what way are they still being produced and read or acted out? What exactly is this about?
Mostly a wedding poem is a sort of a rhyming sort of description of the life of the bride and the groom. And yeah, it's like a life up till the point where they get married, and a sort of, you know, description of how they are as a person and how they work together and how we hope and dream that they will become very happy and have lots of children, that sort of thing, that sort of stuff.
And they're often written, and like, how often are they written in the national standard language? How often are they written in Saxon?
I don't know exactly. I think they're if ever they're written, it's in Low Saxon,
and
so they're not in Dutch, because I remember my wedding, my own mother wrote one of these wedding poems in Low Saxon. Well, she never writes in Low Saxon, but now she did,
and then she reads it out loud. You know, on a stage at the wedding, at the reception or something.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I showed you once, I have an old written copy, sheet with a wedding poem, which was either for my grandparents or for people they knew, probably a manuscript from the 40s, perhaps, also in North Overijssel's Stellingwaters. Which is another example of a wedding poem.
So they're highly stylized forms of Low Saxon.
Yes. Which actually touches on an important thing to realize, that when a language makes it, and we just said that Saxon was doing very well for itself in the late Middle Ages with the impulse of the Hanseatic Trading League behind it, then that league started to decline in importance. The language was never quite standardized. It started to fragment into loads of varieties with very limited self-conscious among speakers of a language. Mm-hmm. A language as such, right? They would say they would call their language by the name of their town or region and not look very much beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what you get when you lose central government, right? When you lose your, Lübeck used to be the center, of course, that we just established that. But when they lost their power or even their, you know, their, range of influence over the rest, it was highly fashionable to speak like the people from Lübeck first, because that's where the center was, right? That's what everybody modeled their speech on. So when that gradually loses influence, it peters out and it, you know, it loses their, you know, the central, you know, the central scope of things. So everybody just proceeds from there on out, right? And as Dutch is gradually getting more important, you see a move towards more Dutch sort of speech. Of course, there's a geographical element there as well, because you can see that the more Western varieties of Low Saxon start to sound more and more like Dutch of those days. And I can tell that there used to be a peat bog, you know, sort of shielding Twente from the rest of the country. And for a long time, that made us more inclined towards Munster, which is in Westphalia. And that is why you still can hear traces of Westphalian in our Low Saxon of today.
Yeah. And so when the standard languages have become more and more clearly defined and are starting to be spoken by a growing number of people, and more people are making the switch from their regional language to the standard language, or speak them side by side for a generation or so, and then people switch over entirely to the standard language, which then becomes the only language aside from English, you know, which they are capable of, which they are have any knowledge of. Mm-hmm. Now with the very fast change of the 19th and certainly the 20th century, you get the radio, you get newspapers, you get increasing literacy, you get increasing mobility of people, and all of this, television eventually, all of this is like harnessed in the service of the standard languages.
I think I need to interrupt you there, because I think we've glossed over or brushed aside a very important period for Low Saxon, which is the French period. Don't you think that is a very important part of our speech, because there's loads of French loans in Low Saxon?
Yeah, so you're referring to the Napoleonic period when France all of a sudden started to conquer most of Europe, and mm-hmm. and French you know, became the language of reference, and just like people now look to English for neologisms and loans, and it's clearly by a long shot the most prestigious language around. Mm-hmm. In the early 1800s, and for a long time after that, it was French, until gradually it started mm-hmm. to be replaced by English in the 20th century. So how did French, that like temporary strong influence and presence of French influence Saxon and or Dutch?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you tell me.
How did that happen?
What happened in the first place?
What happened? Well, the French, under Napoleonic rule, mm-hmm. Napoleontic rule, I'm not sure if that's the right word, they conquered most of the Netherlands and parts of northern Germany as well. And I think they left a number of stadtholders, like city wardens, in place. They instated those to look after the interests of the local people and to make sure they know what the French are on about. And there's even mentioning of those people in the book I just mentioned, like from Van Wieruwen. And for some reason, they got on quite well, I believe. And at least that's what I, you know, filter out from them, what I read. Like they're borrowing words like very simple words, and like for instance the word for sidewalk or pavement, We could say an estupa, but locally here, people also call it a trottoir, which is clearly a French loan. And I don't know why, but they didn't feel like the... it didn't feel especially highbrow or something. I'm not sure how that came about, but would be interesting if people could explain more about that in the comment section. But yeah, I'm not the expert here, but I do notice that there are a lot of French influenced words still in our Low Saxon today. So that would be interesting to find out. My favourite example, of course, being poule patate. My father used to tell us about the poule patate. We used to go walking through the park here, and there's this cage full of exotic birds, and in there are a number of poule patates, which the English word eludes me at the moment, but it's a direct loan from French, because I think we hadn't seen those birds before. And they were imported.
Guinea fowl,
that's right. You're exactly right. Guinea fowl is, in French, would be poule pintade, which means, a dotted hen. And in proper Low Saxon, you'd say that's a stiphenne. But nobody says that. They all say poule pintade or poule patate. All local varieties have sort of taken over the same word, but applied their own local pronunciation rules to those loans. So you get a lot of variation within those French loans as well, which is very interesting to note. But again, yeah, the French came and stayed for about 20 years. I'm not sure exactly how long they stayed, but long enough to influence one generation. And yeah, then they sodded off back to France. And, they left a legacy of certain words. And we still use them to this day.
Yes, so clearly French left its imprint not just on Saxon, but on Dutch and German, for very obvious reasons. When the French Empire started to gobble up these territories, even if temporarily, French left its imprint, and it's quite noticeable in the vocabulary, and for some reason, it tends to stand out in Saxon, where you have a fair number of French loans that you don't see in Dutch, or possibly in German. You sort of sprung this on me, so I haven't got any examples. Like, I'm horrible at improvising. Something did occur to me that in certain cities, you have a phonetic feature where the R, for instance, in to talk, praten, sounds like praten, mm-hmm. which in the Netherlands is called brouwer, or mm-hmm. the verb brouwen. Is pronouncing the R mm-hmm. like R, which is believed to have come from French, because in the cities, you know, it was seen as fashionable, and it was not adopted in the countryside. So you have these city varieties of Saxon that, among other differences, stand out for this peculiar pronunciation of their R, compared to the surrounding countryside where that did not penetrate.
Which is very interesting, because as a side note, where I live, the tip of the tongue R, like the R, is very much a sign of proficiency. And me, as a child, I could not make that sound. So they made me practice to sound more like the locals. So I used to speak with this brow R, like it's like the Northumbrian burr, which is a very interesting phenomenon happening in Northern England. So yeah, I could never say, groot. So they made, I always said groot with a r, so which is your back in the throat. It's a throat R instead of a tongue tip R. So, I know what you mean. It's usually a sign of you know, more of a city or an urban dialect.
Sure, well, that's a little phonetic aside. Now, zooming out a little bit again. So where a lot of the developments you see in the 19th and 20th centuries provide a boost to the standard languages because they're being pretty much for a large part exclusively used for the new print media and then the radio and then television. The opposite happens for Saxon and clearly other regional languages as well, because a lot of what we're discussing, what we're saying about Saxon, happened just the same for Walloon and regional languages all over the place in, you know, in France and Italy and further afield.
Yeah, and before I interrupted you and we got on the sidetrack, you were skipping ahead towards the 1940s, 1950s. Am I right?
Well, in terms of the mass media really beginning to burst upon us with, especially with television, yeah, that takes us to those to the 50s. But what I was getting at is that, whereas now the standard languages have got everything going for them, what you see for Saxon and other regional languages is that they're still now talking up to the mid 20th century, pretty much universally spoken in their respective areas, you know, by the people, but still the areas for which the language is considered to be suitable become more and more constrained. So where, say, Dutch or German are being used to write anything from some verse to a scientific paper, Saxon has been pushed into this romantic corner of describing old rituals and customs and the way of life of country folk, the lives of farmers, the kind of literature that gets produced is plainly romantic. Now, obviously, in the for the standard languages, you also had this romantic kind of theme in the 19th century. But then in the 20th century, people start to break out of this romantic mold and explore new literary styles, whereas romanticism remains firmly lodged in place for Saxon. And anyone to whom it occurs to write a poem or a serialized story that may eventually get published in book format, chances are that they are going to write about their childhood, the past, life in the countryside, life on the farm, how, you know, the beautiful reminiscence of their village and the melancholy about having left it for the big city where the opportunities lay, a general looking back. And this restriction to ever smaller areas of the language is just a general theme for regional languages where step by step, its practical use becomes more constrained, and where it is used in speech or in writing, it's like pushed into these reservations that are well recognized and beyond which one does not venture. And in speech, what happens is that it's used for informal speech, informal conversations between people, you know, who know each other, family members, or people who live in the same village or town. It's certainly not used in education. So it starts to become identified with these more lowly, less ambitious areas of life. And once that identification starts to stick to the language, it's like mud being thrown at it, and it sort of accelerates its demise. I give the floor back to you for a minute.
Thank you very much, Chris. Yes, you're quite right. I had the thought that since it became more and more associated with farmers and farm work, and it was, you know, the domains of public life in which Low Saxon was deemed suitable, became more and more, you know, restricted. So with it, narrowed down our idea of what it was suitable for. So it used to be a full-fledged language, right? So suitable for you know, the barrister until the doctor until the farmer, and you know, the parish priest. But since those people had a certain idea that if you're educated, you can't speak Low Saxon, they didn't use it anymore. So we lost a huge load of our vocabulary, specially suited for those sort of professions. So our idea that it's exclusively a form language comes from the fact that more people have abandoned it. And it's very funny to note that while in the east of the Netherlands it became more and more a farm language, in the north they still associated with fishermen. And that undoubtedly has to do with the proximity of the North Sea and the Eastern Sea.
If we're talking northern Germany.
What did I say?
We're talking northern Germany, like East Frisia and Holstein and those areas.
Exactly. So it's a bit of a clash of imagery there. And I always find it very funny to point out to people that we live so far removed from the North Sea that we don't have any words for that. And for fishing or for, you know, of course we do have words for fishing, but not in the sense that we have a jargon for it, whereas we have retained a huge, you know, vocabulary, especially suited for farm life and, you know, the equipment and the farming tools. And since so many people abandoned the language, those words were forgotten. And of course, you mentioned shortly, briefly, you mentioned the media. I don't know at what point in time we are at the moment. Have we passed the 1940s yet?
Well, if you want to talk about specifically the impact of the media on, or the mass media on, regional languages, you would want to point out that newspapers were being started up as early as the closing stage of the 1700s, whereas radio didn't come along until the early 20th century, and then television didn't really get going until the 50s, 60s. I would say that for a long time, the mass media were, although they were making more and more people familiar with with the standard language of the country they were living in. They were probably changing in subtle manners regional speech, you know, because of the prestigious examples that were provided to people, and people started being exposed to more and more. For a long time, that didn't change matters very much until in the second half of the 20th century, really the post-war period.
Right.
You get television and you get massive expansion of print media, magazines that people start reading, weeklies and monthlies and dailies, all of them written in the standard language, in Dutch or in German, and then
exclusively, right?
Yes, and television, like television becomes a huge focal point of diffusion of the standard language, and you can listen to it until your ears bleed, but you're not going to hear Saxon on Dutch television. It's slightly different now for Germany because the NDR, the Norddeutscher Rundfunk, which is, I guess, based in Niedersachsen. Don't know if it takes in North Rhine-Westphalia. No, because they have the Westdeutscher Rundfunk. So they broadcast some, you know, limited and modest content in Plattdeutsch, in the Low Saxon of northern Germany. But in the Netherlands, you don't even get that. So television content is produced in Dutch, standard Dutch, aside, of course, from foreign content, a lot of English and French, and that gets subtitled in our case. But the local languages, by and large, are invisible and inaudible. But there's something that goes a step further than that. The fact that the languages, the regional languages, not even by regional media that started coming up also in the, a bit later in the 80s, they didn't adopt the local languages as a vehicle for the diffusion of news and content and talk shows. And well, they did up to a point, and local radio did have Saxon material. But in the end, you can say that the standard language won out. Certainly today, if you listen to the radio and television for the province of, say, well, any province really,
wouldn't you say that apart from the general negative attitude towards anything non-standard from the people that held the reins, it had something to do with the lacking quality of broadcasting equipment in the early 40s and 50s. Of course, they started off experimenting with these things, and we all know recordings of those days, and they weren't very clear yet, and they weren't very as clear as this podcast will be. If that is a correct standard. Don't you think that because they kept in mind that the signal would be less clear, that they'd, you know, say speak clearly, and we need to speak, enunciate very properly, and we have to do it in a way that anybody will understand. And of course, that anybody will understand, the only language that anybody will understand is standard Dutch. So that's how that came about. And of course, the center of media, the media center in the Netherlands, is in the Gooi, the Hilversum area, which is slightly southeast of Amsterdam, I believe. and yeah. And they, of course, pushed their own dialect, which is the Hoi dialect.
Yes, well, so this
so in a sense, it is a non-standard, or it's all regional, just not our region.
Yeah, well, the drive to speak the standard language and to try as best you can to ignore the regional language of your own area, I think has everything to do with the prestige attached to the standard language and not so much to technology and fears about the, supposed superior enunciatory qualities of the standard language.
Right. Yeah, of course. But yeah, that might be one of the underlying issues. But of course, the prestige of the language played a huge part.
What I wanted to say about this is that so the Saxon does not get used to produce media content. It doesn't get used in schools, but it goes a step beyond that because on television, I was growing up and watching Dutch television in the 80s and 90s. I don't remember a single program dedicated to the existence of a language like Low Saxon or whatever name they wanted to give it back at the in the day, or for that matter to Frisian. So you get documentaries and programs with cultural content that describe festivities and folkloric phenomena, but the language is not just Saxon, but also other regional languages like Limburgian, is as though they don't exist. They exist for people in local communities to speak to each other and to quickly switch to the standard language as soon as anybody comes within earshot who is not their neighbor or their relative. So it's very much under the radar and hidden. It doesn't get talked about. It doesn't get taught in schools. Now, clearly it doesn't get taught because the general idea is that anything that is not the standard language needs to just quietly fall by the wayside and start disappearing because it is impeding progress. But even as a cultural phenomenon, like, okay, so it's the 80s, it's the 90s. There's a general belief that only the standard language is of any value. But there is also recognition that many people, and especially older segments of the population, very generally still speak very different regional languages with varying degrees of mutual intelligibility to the standard language. Certainly for Germany, like Plattdeutsch, Low German, Low Saxon is very different from High German, not just mutually intelligible unless you begin to actually study it. Even in terms of a recognition of, okay, this is it, we have a biglossal situation, and as a cultural phenomenon, it has its, it just exists. So you would want to pay attention to it. I think it's due to the shame and stigma attached to regional, non-standard, local varieties of speech that national media and, to a large extent, even the regional media pays zero attention to anything that is going on in and around Saxon. Not just the fact that it's being still very widely spoken, but also the literature being produced in it. It's as though none of that exists. None of that gets any, it doesn't get given its due. And that's because it's like people are ashamed to bring it up, either because they're really convinced of the inferiority of regional languages, or they sort of recognize that it's a shame that certain things are dying out, but they intuit that if they touch it, then that's like it's like prodding a wound. Like it's best just covered up a bit and left there, and then it will just, if we look away long enough, it will go away. Mm-hmm. It will go away, and mm-hmm. all we will have left is just standard Dutch, and in today's world, of course, standard English as well. Okay, I'll stop droning, but do you get what I'm...
That's good to hear your thoughts on that. But at the same time, this time you're speaking about, like the 70s and the 80s, those were the time when something happened, right? Because we need to do something, right?
Well, yes, I mean...
And it isn't as if... I'm sorry to interrupt again, but it isn't as if there isn't done anything in the language, but it's just not picked up by the national media or the regional media even, because there's extensive writing going on. There's poetry, there's literature being written, even in the 1950s and 60s. I think the first dictionary of my local variety was written in 1959. The nationally renowned writer Belcampo, he wrote like travel accounts and, you know, the wondrous travel of Belcampo through Europe. I think that's the translation of it. So there were quite a few individuals. So it wasn't anything, you know, coordinated, but there were quite a few individuals who still believe that this language is beautiful and worth preserving and worth creating in. So,
yeah. Well, they set up their organizations, of which
I was getting there.
Yeah. there are quite a few. Do you want to carry on a bit about these organized structures that are springing up?
So yes, there are certain groups springing up that one of the most I'm most familiar with is the Kring voor de Twentse Spraken.
Meaning
that it's a circle for the preservation of the Twentse language. And here you can clearly see that it's focused on one dialect in particular. And most of these groups of dialects, these dialect preservation groups and cultural preservation groups, they focus on their own dialect exclusively. And anything beyond that, they are somewhat somewhat aware that these exist, but they don't want anything to do with it because it sounds different and it's, well, I wouldn't say less in worth, but just not worth considering. So you have the Kring voor de Twentse Spraken, you have, I think, the Staring Institute, which was named after a man from the Achterhoek region who wrote in the local variety. I think in Groningen, in Grun, they have their own, sort of organization that, is concerned about preserving the Groning dialect. And you have the Stellingwerve Schrijversronde springing up. So there's quite a lot of activity going on. And I think in the 1970s, that's where we're headed, the 1975, somewhere in the Achterhoek, you know, knocking over everything we've ever known, there's this one group who smashes all, everything there is to know, what we should do in the Netherlands, right? They, there were pop groups, of course, springing up, and they were all singing in this, well, strange sort of idea of what English should be, like Dunglish. They were producing disco songs in English. And they were, you know, copying everything that was done in the United States, and anything the Brits did, we had to do as well, and in our variety of English. But there was one group from the Achterhoek, which was called Normaal, and that name was chosen deliberately, because what is normal? What is normal? And they decided that this is enough. We're going to do things differently. We're not going to, you know, slavishly follow the masses. We're going to make rock music in our own language, in their local variety of Low Saxon. This was like, you know, like a bomb went off. because this changed everything. They made national headlines and they, well, it was the first, their song Urenhart was the first Low Saxon song that made it to the national hit lists, and I think landed in at first place, right? At first in the top spot. So they opened up a whole world of, you know, renewed recognition and appreciation for their local culture.
Right. I want to touch on two areas. So the music scene, what you're referring to, something that gets going in the 70s, 80s, is referred to in the Netherlands as the dialect renaissance, where groups and singers start making use of the local language rather than either English or the nationwide language. You see this both in the Netherlands and in Germany, with artists like Normaal, as you mentioned, or singer-songwriters like Ada Stahl in Groningen, Hannes Wader in North Germany, and Knut Kiesewetter also in North Germany.
And Torfrock, I think they're roughly around the same time when Normaal springs up. You get Torfrock in the north of Germany. And they're a rock group as well. And they sing in the local Low Saxon variety of, I think, East Frisia, but I'm not entirely sure there.
Yeah, you get the Groningen group Turf, who got going very early, around the same time as Normaal, I believe. So, like, it's like a new avenue of expression for the local language, is pop music and the lyrics being written and sung in Saxon. And for Normaal, the reason they were so, drew so much attention to them is that not only did they sing in their Achterhoeks Low Saxon, but they made a case for the emancipation of the image of farmers. So after the Second World War, all of the emphasis had been on reconstruction, urbanization, industrialization, modernization, the development of technology, moving from the countryside to the city where the jobs were, and farmers, where, you know, if you go several decades back, just about everybody was a farmer, so there was nothing special or unusual about being a farmer. But now farmers sort of started to be associated with the backwards life, started to be made fun of. Like when I grew up in the 80s, 90s, one of the worst things you could get tarred with was to be called a boer, a farmer, domme boer, stupid farmer, dumb farmer, which is very different in South Africa, where boer refers to the Afrikaners and is a matter of pride. But in the Netherlands, to be called a boer is to be called backwards and to speak unintelligible gibberish and to not be very educated. And now Normaal very much celebrated the farming life and countryside living and celebration and living in the here and now and enjoying life and not making things more complicated than they were, not being too highfalutin and fancy, really living up to this Dutch motto of "Doe maar normaal, dan doe je al gek genoeg." Just act normal. That's crazy enough as it is. Well, that's doubly the case for people in the eastern countryside in the Saxon areas who are not inclined at all to stand out or to be exaggeratedly ambitious, which of course doesn't help in terms of defending their own culture and language, because they're very inclined to say, okay, we'll take a step back and hand over to the powers that be. In any case, you have these new forms of expression for the language, like these musical groups, and also going back a bit, so literature had been being produced in Saxon through the 19th and 20th centuries, but had sort of got stuck in the groove of Romanticism for the most part, whereas the standard languages developed from there and went through a plethora of literary styles. Back in this, on the Saxon scene, as late as the, well, still today, for a lot of people using the language to write in, it's about reminiscing about the past, glorifying country life, or waxing lyrical about one's village. So in the 70s, you get a rebellion against that, where specifically in the province of Trento, a couple of youngsters from the baby boomer generation who grew up in the 50s and 60s and still spoke Saxon as their mother tongue, they wanted to see the emancipation, just what Normal wanted for the farmer lifestyle and a recognition of the economic importance of farmers for the country, obviously. They wanted for literature a complete destruction of taboos, because you couldn't write about sex or subjects like homosexuality that had taboos that had been assaulted for several decades in the standard languages, but that were still quite firmly in place for dialect writing, as it was often called. And they set up a new magazine here in Drenthe, called Root, which appears, don't know if it's always appeared, well, it's appeared 4, 5, 6 times a year on average, began to appear in I think, 79 off the top of my head, and still exists and is pretty much the only true blue literary Saxon magazine still around. Several others having arisen and then gone on for a while and bitten the dust again. So you do get a new appreciation as the 20th century starts to grow old and hoary and creaky, and the 21st century is impatient to take over. With the dialect renaissance, you get a new appreciation for at least the cultural value of Saxon, right? Which does not quite mean that these defenders of the cultural value and cultural modes of expression in literature, in music, and what have you, of the regional language necessarily believe that the language has much of a future or a right to exist beyond this cultural stockade.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's always a bit strange, in my opinion, because I'm of the firm belief that language carries everything. But yeah, there are loads of people who love Low Saxon culture, but loathe the Low Saxon language. They engage in all kinds of cultural activities, like, you know, wearing old, the drachten garments from the 18th century, keeping certain crafts alive, like clog making or stuff like that. But at the same time, when you ask them, do you teach your children to speak Low Saxon? Well, the thought hasn't even crossed their mind. Of course not. So there, a lot of emphasis is being put on, I mean, of course, we're approaching the 90s here, and the 80s and the 90s, where we both grew up. So there's lots of emphasis on cultural things, but not so much on preserving the language, or at least, I mentioned one of these groups before. I've been to these nights, these preservation group, dialect nights, where people recite poems and tell each other stories. Someone occasionally sings a song, but no effort is being made to compile some sort of curriculum for making people learn this language.
By nights, you don't mean they party through the night. You mean they meet up in the early evening, and they're generally of a more advanced age, aren't they?
That's right. The average age ranges between 60 and 80 years old. Yeah, so And those generations seem to not be able to fathom that there are generations now who haven't been brought up in this language and don't hear it at home. So we need to treat this language as a separate language, you know, create course material from scratch, like very basic stuff like simple grammatical things like how do you parse this verb or how do you conjugate it, right? How do you speak this language? Where do you start? How do you pronounce it? What happens? How do you morph it? You know, how do you conjugate it? What are its expressions? So, yeah, what you see is that many of these dialect knights, they're focused on, you know, reminiscing, which you established earlier. As strongly as people feel that this language should be preserved, they don't know how to do it.
Yes, so looking back becomes a central theme when it comes to appreciation at all of Saxon. So it has a lot of detractors that really believe the language ought to disappear because it is impeding the acquisition, the proper acquisition of the standard language, which we as activists of some stripe or other or proponents of the preservation and continued use of Saxon would say, well, as long as you teach languages consistently and separate one language from the other, then just like you can learn, say, Dutch and German or German and English, you can learn a national language and a regional language, or just like you can learn your local variety of Norwegian and more standard Nynorsk or Bokmål Norwegian, or just like in Switzerland, you can speak Switzerdeutsch, which is a thriving language, rather different from standard German, as well as have a perfect mastery of standard German. And no one can accuse the Swiss of being like a failed society where people, you know, are groping about in the dark because they haven't learned to speak properly. We have these examples of how it's possible to carry on in the modern era if people want to, speaking a local language that doesn't span the whole national territory, like in Spain, Galician and Catalan and Basque, as well as the national language that unites the whole country.
And so ends our third episode on the darkest of eras in the history of Low Saxon yet. Next up is that new age that was introduced by the internet revolution, a new era in which the old ways in which we communicated or got our news, as well as our sense of fashion, got completely upturned. And new ways gained traction and shaped how we feel about this language today. The 21st century. But before we get round to it, we'd be delighted if you'd take a moment and gave us a thumbs up and a share. For now, Rothaar.